You are listening to the podcast When Life Gives You Lemons, presented by me, Emma Levy. Having worked with elite athletes for most of my career, it's always intrigued me that a significant number of high-performing individuals have encountered some form of adversity earlier in their lifetime. My fascination into this grew when I had my own brush with adversity, when I was diagnosed with breast cancer in May 2020, in the midst of the global pandemic at the age of only 36. During this period, I questioned whether it was my positive mindset or maybe something deeper, which enabled me to bounce back and to train and compete for a triathlon just 1 month following completion of all active cancer treatment. The goal of this podcast is to explore this concept further by meeting a variety of high-performing individuals who have experienced adversity, but who have come back stronger. So today I'm welcoming Lucy Gossage to the podcast. Lucy wears many hats. She's currently a consultant oncologist in Nottingham. But behind this professional exterior, she was and still is a super athlete, being a 14 times Ironman champion. On retirement in 2018, she didn't hang up her running shoes like most people, but instead continued racing in ultra-extreme events, but with less training and more medicine, and somehow found the time to co-found a charity, community-based initiative 5K Your Way, Move Against Cancer. Lucy, thank you for chatting to me today. I actually came across you through your own podcast, Move Against Cancer. And I think I came across you when I was going through cancer myself and I found your podcast with the inspiring stories. And I really enjoyed that back then. But then more recently, you started cropping up on my Instagram feed with posts of you competing in this crazy race, which I'd never heard of, which we're going to talk about called the Spine Race. So I thought this sounded really interesting. So I looked it up. I was like, what is this spine race? So for the listeners who also haven't heard of it, I'm just going to explain. It's a nonstop 268-mile ultra race along the Pennine Way. So it's 13,300 metres of climbing over, I think, 8 days in extreme conditions, really, because it's snowing, it's blizzards, it's through the night, so there's darkness. I mean, this is just madness. And you did all this and... Did you come second in the race?
No, I was actually third. Okay. I was second over the line, but third in the race.
So you came third, which is still unbelievable. And you raised £31,000 for Move Against Cancer.
Yeah, which is that's the unbelievable bit,
well,
I think.
I think it's all unbelievable. But basically all of that, I thought, I've got to get Lucy on the podcast. So here you are. Sorry, that was quite a long spiel. And there's quite a lot of things I want to talk about. You're an oncologist, so you're a cancer doctor in the NHS. And having worked in the NHS myself for many years and having had many medic friends, I know how stressful and busy your job is. And we're going to talk a little bit more later about your actual work with cancer patients. But firstly, I am intrigued how you have managed to become such a sporting champion with that work and hectic study schedule, I'm sure. So can you tell us how you got into triathlon?
I mean, this is a story I have told many times, but it is absolutely true. So I firmly believe that all the best decisions in life happen as a kind of a random click in your brain. And yeah, I did my first triathlon. I was a junior doctor. I'd been with a guy for a long time. We started having some issues and a friend said, well, why did I put on a lot of weight, was working hard, playing hard, you know, doing what junior doctors do. And a friend said, why don't you do a triathlon? I still don't know why they said do a triathlon, but I was like, yeah, why not, actually? So I signed up for the London Triathlon, absolutely loved it, finished bang on the middle of the pack. I've got a video of me, like I was a lot bigger. I did not look like I was going to be good at it, but just kind of waddling around the run with this massive grin on my face. And then a week later, my boyfriend and I broke up. I was devastated. A couple of weeks later, I was teaching some medical students on the ward and they told me about this thing called Ironman. And I said, what's an Ironman? Their friend had just done it. And they told me it was a 2.4 mile swim, 112 mile bike ride, and then a marathon. I was like, that is bonkers. But there was a little seed in my brain, and a few weeks later, I was out dancing with some friends in a nightclub. I was like, if I'm single on New Year's Day, I'm going to do an Ironman. And New Year's Eve, I met a guy who'd done an Ironman who said it was the most amazing thing, and that was it. That was fate. So I kind of went to the gym on the 2nd of January, pressed go on the treadmill and said, like, if you can run a half marathon, you're going to enter this Ironman. So I never ran anywhere near that. Press go, ran the 13 miles, stumbled off it at the end and went home and signed up.
Wow.
So that's how I got into triathlon. And it was just, it was a one-off challenge. It was just something that, you know, had been triggered, I guess, by this relationship ending and wanting a new challenge in my life. The reason I got good at it was actually because when I moved to Cambridge to do a research PhD, so I was a junior doctor when I signed up for the Ironman, then I started my registrar training, special where you start specializing in oncology. I think the week before I did that Ironman. And as part of oncology training at that point in time, most people ended up doing a PhD. So I moved to Cambridge to do a research PhD, not because I was really interested in the project or because I had loads of friends in Cambridge, but just because it was the best place to go to do a PhD. And I hated it. I'm missing patients. I felt really unsupported. And because of that, I think training became a way to validate my days. So until that point, it was very much a social thing that I did as an excuse almost to go to the pub with friends after work. But it then became actually a way of validating my days. Like the lab wasn't working, so at least I'd done a good run session. And that's really how I ended up getting good at triathlon. And very long story short, I became a good amateur. Then I raced, then I got my pro license. I was still working full time. Then I went part-time. And then when I finally finished my PhD, I had nearly 2.5 years, nearly three seasons, just racing professionally, not doing any oncology.
Oh, so you literally took a career break, did you? A full career break?
Took a career break, had 3 seasons racing full-time, traveling around the world, making a living from triathlon, and then went back to work, continued racing professionally for a couple of years, and then retired 2018. So wow. Yeah, that's kind of life in a nutshell. Or triathlon life in a nutshell. Yeah.
Those 14 times where you won the competitions, were they in the time where you were not working?
Do you know what? Actually, most of them were when I went back to work as an oncologist. So I had, I think, 2.5 years, something like that, where I was working part-time and racing professionally. And I think I won 8 of the races in that time. And people, it's really interesting reflecting on being a full-time athlete. It is an incredible experience. And I am so grateful that I had that time. But it is harder than people realize. And it's fundamentally, it's very monotonous. You're doing the same thing again, again, again. And I struggled a bit with pressure. But I struggled more with the question of, was it all worth, you know, what was the point? Like, you're just trying to make yourself faster. It's an incredibly selfish pursuit. And I did miss feeling that I was doing something bigger with it. So I think when I went back to work, it took away time, but actually it gave me that balance that meant that triathlon just felt pure fun to me. Mm. It was this kind of pure unadulterated hobby that there was no pressure. I could go back to being the underdog. So whilst I had the most incredible time, and I look back on those 3 years of being full-time with so much gratitude, and it was incredible, but actually it is harder than people realize. So I think working was actually, in some ways, it was my secret weapon. And the other thing that I always reflect on is actually, it really reminded me how lucky I was to have a body that would allow me to do what I was doing. And I use the mantra, choosing to suffer is a privilege. And I don't say that lightly, because I think with people, I see so many people at work whose bodies don't let them do what they want to do. And it really helps me with the tough training sessions or the tough time in races, just reminding myself that I'm hurting because I want to be hurting, and it's a choice to be hurting. And I think that kind of deep knowledge and deep understanding of how lucky I was to have the time that, you know, to be able to live and race professionally, earn money from a hobby, it was just bonkers. But I think oncology reminded me to really appreciate that.
Yeah, I think that mantra, you know, choosing to suffer as a privilege is so interesting, because that's a specific thing where my mindset has changed since I had cancer. So when I now go for a run, I don't think, I was just explaining off camera how I'm training for a marathon, and I don't think, oh, I've got to go for a run. I think I'm so lucky I can go for a run. I can still then be miserable on the run. But I've definitely switched that to be like, I'm so lucky that my body can do this. And I do wonder if your work specifically in oncology rather than other forms of medicine did help to drive you to some of those victories.
I think so. And I think I always used to say when I was talking to my boss about going part-time at work to race triathlon professionally, he was so supportive, but I remember thinking he'd just think it was a waste of time. And I was coming out with this stuff about how I thought that taking this time out would make me a better doctor in the long run. And it was, if I'm honest, it was empty words that I was saying to convince him, but also to convince myself that what I was doing wasn't a waste of time. But now when I look back, it has made me a better doctor in so many ways, not least because it's kind of helped me take a step back off the career ladder and, you know, work out what I want to do and why I want to do it and not just be climbing to the top to get to the top, but really think about where I wanted to go. But I do think it gives you this really deep insight into how short life is and how lucky we are to be able to do what we do. And it sounds such a cliche and I don't always remember that. And I, you know, there are certainly times where I go out for a run and I'm like, wow. Or, you know, last night running home from work and it was chucking it down with rain. I was like, oh, this is miserable. Why do I not just drive like everyone else does? But fundamentally, I think oncology is such a life-affirming specialty if you let it be, because it does remind you how good life is and how we should just say yes to stuff and follow our dreams and not do stuff because we've always just done it.
Yeah. It must be a constant reminder, actually, because you're having to face life and death every day, I imagine, and deliver the bad news to patients that, you know, like I described, the news that no one ever wants to hear. So doing that every day must really take it out of you. And I think you've seemed to have managed to kind of switch that into a real positive, life-affirming way for you. Do you agree?
Sometimes it can take it out of you, and sometimes it does. And there are always people that hurt you more than others. And there are times where, you know, I use exercise as my coping strategy. And there are times where I've had to literally ride pretty much for the whole weekend to stop thinking about stuff that's happened. But I think I've learned, you know, I've been a consultant 5 years now, and actually I've learned to redefine success in oncology, because success, particularly I do a lot of work with younger people with testicular cancers and sarcomas, and a lot of them have cancers that aren't curable. A lot of them have cancers that are curable, but you can't just have success about curing people. So I've learned to really redefine success. And actually, I think one of the things that I now see as success, which I didn't initially, is having difficult conversations and going away thinking, that was really tough, but I think I did that as well as anyone could have done it. Because I, the longer I do it, the more I realize how delivering news can change the whole trajectory for someone's kind of treatment pathway. So things like that I didn't see as success at the start, I've learned to kind of reevaluate as success. Mm-hmm. Even though on the face of it, it doesn't feel like success.
Yeah, I think it's probably also just being able to give people time, isn't it? And I imagine sometimes in the NHS that can be quite a challenge if you've got a massive clinic list and you just don't have the time that you want to give to everyone.
Do you know, I learned when I was a registrar, actually, I had an oncology, I was working with a consultant and her clinics were always running 3 hours late. But she said to me once, yeah, it's awful, but patients know when they get in this room, they have as much time as they need. And I think I work on that philosophy. It's not ideal, but actually giving people the time they need. And it always comes back to you, because if you don't give people the time they need, then they need another appointment at some point. So it does come back to the NHS, and people don't like it. They like the numbers and they like to, you know, people in and out and managers and things don't like that. But I think that's something I've taken with me as a consultant. And the guy I work with, we share our clinics, he's very much got the same philosophy. And I think some of the regs find it really frustrating. Like, you've spent an hour with that patient, like there's 15 people waiting. I don't know, maybe my patients don't think that, but that's how I try to work.
Yeah, I know. I think it's so important being sat on the other side of the desk. I think it's so important to know your doctor's got time. And one of those things I wanted to talk about was exercise with cancer. And that takes us to talk about your initiative, 5K Your Way Move Against Cancer. Can you just tell me a bit about that and a bit about that inception?
Yeah, so, oh gosh, it's my passion project. So 5K Your Way is one arm of Move Against Cancer charity. So it's all under one umbrella. And I guess the overwhelming mission of Move Against Cancer is to support and inspire and empower people affected by cancer to move. And there is a lot of evidence that exercise is one of the very few things that anyone with cancer, pretty much anybody with cancer at any stage of their cancer diagnosis, can do to make themselves feel better, but probably also improve their outcomes in terms of treatments, etc. 5K Your Way started in 2018, and it was a young guy that I went to see on the teenage cancer ward. He was about 21, and I hadn't treated him. I'd just been asked to go and give him a prescription, and he'd had a brain tumor, a very rare kind of brain tumor, and he'd theoretically been cured of his cancer. But I just got chatting to him, and in the process, he'd put on several stone in weight. He'd lost his jobs. He'd lost his friends. I was spending all day asleep and all night awake playing computer games. And I just remember walking off the ward, I was a registrar, and just thinking, what is the point if, you know, we're curing people with cancer, but that's the quality of life that they're left with? And I just had this overwhelming urge of, we've got to do something. And I love Park Run. I just thought, well, maybe we could get a group of young people to build up towards it every 3 months or something. Asked around the hospital, no one bought into it. They were like, you're just a runner. No one else wants to run. So then I heard about Gemma Hillier Moses, who just founded Move Charity the year before. So Gemma was a runner. She'd had lymphoma. She'd not had any support to kind of stay active during her treatment, get active afterwards. So she had founded Move Charity with the goal of providing other young people with the support that she didn't have. So I reached out to Gemma. She lived 10 miles away. We have coffee, kind of shared ideas. We're like, oh my God, we've got the same vision. Let's just do it. We launched 5K Your Way in Nottingham in 2018, and it really was just going to be a kind of support group linked to Part One. We thought, let's just put out flyers, get anyone affected by cancer to come along with their healthcare professionals and walk or jog or run or do as much or little as they want to. And was never going to be more than a local kind of support group. But through social media, people heard about it. And all of a sudden, people were getting in contact saying, can we do this? Can we do it? And I think in the January after, we had 8 groups. In the February, we had 16. And we've now got nearly 95 groups across the UK and Ireland. Wow. And it's a really simple concept. So each group's led by volunteer ambassadors, all of whom have been affected by cancer in some way. And we just meet at these park runs on the last Saturday of every month, walk, and we're very clear, like, walk is the first thing, or jog, or run, or just come and cheer or volunteer. And a lot of our group come and volunteer, and then go and have a coffee and a chat afterwards. And it's about using activity as a way to build connections, take back some of that control, and be around people who get what it's like to live with cancer in a positive environment, not just sitting in a room with crappy coffee and crappy digestives. I love it. And it kind of then since founding that, like, Move Against Cancer's really come together. So we've got an online program for young people that supports them to get back into activity after their cancer treatment. So it's eight sessions with online cancer rehab instructors. And then the other kind of missing piece of the jigsaw is the resources, which is a work in progress. But how do we support and inspire and empower as many people as possible to challenge that myth that rest is best? Because so many people with cancer still think they have to rest, yeah. And that's not true.
Yeah. So when I had breast cancer, and I've told this story on the podcast many times, but exercise, you know, it really did save my life physically and emotionally. And what's really funny is I actually set up a running club. So I set up the Big C Running Club for people who'd been touched by cancer. And we used to meet once a week in Highgate Woods in North London. And it was on that running club actually where someone told me about 5K Your Way, and I'd never heard of it, and we were kind of like, oh my God, we should contact you guys. Anyway, we never did. it was amazing because it was like a support group, but it was, you know, everyone had that kind of passion for exercise. Everyone appreciated the positives of exercise, how important it was. We were all different levels, so not everyone was a runner. So we'd have some people that would go off jogging, some of us would just walk, and then we'd all meet for a coffee afterwards in the cafe. But I feel very passionately about exercise with cancer. And that's one of my gripes with the NHS as well, is I don't feel they have enough provision for... What's your thoughts on that?
No, so it is changing. So I think back in 2018, no one talked about movement. I kind of use the word movement because actually most people don't exercise at all. And the word exercise is very off-putting. But yeah, until 2018, back then, I think no one talks about it. Things are changing slowly. So prehab now in the NHS is a really big thing in a lot of centres. So that's exercise before surgery, before cancer surgery, to get you fit for surgery. And it's a no-brainer. You know, it literally is a no-brainer. Of course, the fitter you are before a big operation, the more likely you are to recover quickly from it. And it seems bonkers that it's taken so long for the NHS to actually do something about that. But that is now a big thing. And I think that's then triggering conversations down the line. But one of the things I love from 5K Your Way is getting to know what it's like to be treated for cancer in the hospital that I work. And people tell me, because I'm not their doctor. And it's amazing how many people come and they've been told that they shouldn't run for no reason whatsoever, like literally no reason whatsoever. There's no evidence that you shouldn't go running or even walking. And so, there is still a massive barrier in giving people permission. But that's, I think, one of the things that I love about 5K Your Way. And I know from the stories that I get that the more people hear about it, it's not just the people that come to the groups, it's the people who hear about 5K Your Way. And because we exist, they think, well, actually, if there's all these people with cancer going out and walking or running or doing whatever, then it's okay for me to do it. And I'll go and do my 5K my way, or I'll go and do my circuit session, or I'll go and do my walk with my friends. So it's that kind of ripple effect that, yes, it's the people in the group that we know about. But I'm certain that there's so many more people outside those groups who are changing how they're living their life because we exist.
Yeah, I'm sure. And sometimes it's just being given that, like you said, that permission, because I worked in healthcare, so I knew it was safe and I knew it was advisable to exercise. But there were some hilarious stories of, like, I'd go out for a run, I'd come back and I'd have like this full on nosebleed, you know, that would have been fairly alarming to some people. And I remember being with a friend and she was, you know, fairly alarmed because I was going through chemotherapy at the time. But I was like, it's fine, you know, it's just a nosebleed. And then another time where I would get like this massive vertigo thing and it was just awful. But again, I knew the benefits outweighed those crazy side effects that were going on in my body anyway. And I think things like 5K Your Way just gives people that permission, that confidence that they're able to do it.
Yeah, and I also think what you've said actually is that highlights the gap between the knowledge that healthcare professionals have and what patients actually need. Because if you weren't a medical, you know, if you weren't in kind of healthcare, then probably actually if you've had really bad vertigo, you probably should seek some medical advice. But I know full well, pretty much anyone in the NHS would have said, absolutely not. And you probably have ended up getting admitted for an assessment, which is, you know, that's not needed either. So it's finding the NHS is so unenabling. But part of that is that most NHS professionals aren't active themselves. So if I go and talk to 20 nurses and say, how many of you exercise for 30 minutes three times a week? There's never more than two or three that put up their hands. So for a population that don't exercise, then obviously they're going to assume that the last thing anyone with cancer wants to do is be told to exercise, because it's horrible. Exercise is horrible. Yeah. But I would counter that and say, well, actually what people with cancer want to know is what they can do to make themselves feel better and help, because there's so much control has been taken away. You're given all this stuff that you have to do. You know, you must look out for these side effects. You've got to take these drugs. They're going to cause you. And they just want to do something that can, you know, give them a control, make them feel, so many people want to make them feel that they're doing something to help themselves. And exercise is one of those things. So I'm so passionate about kind of even if exercise isn't part of your life or movement's not part of your life, you still need to have that conversation with people who are diagnosed with cancer.
Yeah.
Because I think there's sorry, I'm on my bandwagon now, but there's I think over 50% of people with cancer will try complementary therapies, which proves the point that they, you know, people want to help themselves. And all on the big cancer research, Millen, all the big websites, none of them mention exercise as a complementary therapy. But it really is. And it really is. And exercise is not going and running a marathon. It's not going and doing the spine race. It might just be getting out and walking around the garden. Yeah. Which is why I guess movement is a better terminology.
Yeah. And am I right in the stats that I remember reading that you can prevent risk of recurrence of cancer by up to 60% with exercise?
For some cancers, yeah. So the evidence is really good that it definitely makes you feel better. It definitely improves mood. It's definitely the best thing for fatigue. So people with cancer, a lot of them get this overwhelming fatigue that by all accounts you can't describe, you can't kind of, it's unimaginable unless you've had it. And exercise is the very best thing to counteract that. And that's so counterintuitive.
Yeah.
But also it probably does improve kind of how well your treatments work, how many dose reductions you need, how you cope with your chemo, how well your cancer even responds to the chemo. And obviously for so many people who live really long lives with metastatic cancer, all the drugs that they're getting and the treatments they're getting have all got side effects. And exercise is one of the biggest ways that you can mitigate a lot of those side effects. So it really is like it's something that we should be telling everyone with cancer diagnosis. We should be giving that information and giving them ways to do something with that information if they want to. We shouldn't be obligating it, but we should be giving them that information.
Yeah.
That's my take on it.
And I always say if you were offered a pill that could give you all those benefits, everyone would take that pill. So
absolutely. And you can't take a pill if you don't know about it.
Yeah. So yeah, I'm fully in agreement. Right, let's move on to a little bit more about you. So you retired from triathlon in 2018. And then, like I said in the introduction, you started to take on some more, I think they sound to me like more extreme adventures. And I'm very fascinated by the mindset involved to do these extreme kind of ultra challenges. I had Marcus Smith on the podcast who did 30 marathons in 30 days in Dubai in like the desert. And I'm just fascinated by that. And I love to get into the mindset of it. So I want to ask you some questions about, you know, the ultras you've done. And I saw on your website, you've done things like the Norseman and Patagon Man, which are the ones I've heard of. And I think they're the ones where you literally jump off the back of a ferry, don't you, into like the sea and the dark, and you have to find your way to the shore. Is that how those start?
Yeah, so that was like I called it my glory year of triathlon. So I'd stopped training professionally. So I wasn't living my life around triathlon, but I was still fit. I was still training quite hard, and I was quite well known. So people were like, "Oh, come and do our race and Patagon. You know, do you want to come and do a race in Patagonia? We'll pay for you to come and do it." I was like, "Absolutely, yeah. Where do I sign up?" So they were iron distance triathlons, but as you say, they're called extreme. They're not that extreme, but you jump off this ferry in the dark, you swim back to shore.
That's quite extreme. The bikes,
it's so cool. And the bikes are point to point and super hilly. And then the runs are often trail, and Norseman finishes on top of this mountain at 2000 meters up. And they were just kind of it was like a transition from doing triathlon seriously to doing it as an adventure. And I think kind of then it was COVID and lockdown, and that kind of actually took me off the professional triathlon bandwagon completely, but gave me this realization that I needed adventures in my life. And I started making adventures on my doorstep. And it was the start of kind of moving towards crazy challenges, ultimately like the spine race.
Yeah. So is the spine race the craziest, most extreme one you've done?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I haven't actually done that many. So I did one 50-mile race, one 100-mile race, and the spine race. So it's kind of quite a steep progression.
Yeah, I mean, because that was 268 miles.
Yeah, and the thing about the spine is, so you have 7 days to do it, and that's tough. But if I was planning to do it in 7 days, it would have been relatively easy. Not easy, but I can do 40 miles a day. I could do that easily.
Really?
But I wasn't. I wasn't racing it to race anyone else, but I was trying to push myself. And what that meant was challenging sleep. And what that meant was digging a very, very, very deep hole. So it was... It was the distance and it's the dark because it's in January, so you've only got 8 hours of daylight. But it was this whole jump into the unknown of sleep that you can't prepare for that until you get on the start line.
So how does that work? You go to checkpoints, don't you? And at the checkpoints at nighttime, you're allowed to sleep. But you're only allowed to sleep for certain periods of time, or is it that you wanted to finish the race as quickly as possible?
No, so I think you're allowed 8 hours. So there are five checkpoints and you're allowed 8 hours in each checkpoint. And again, if I'd gone there and spent 8 hours in each checkpoint, it would have been lovely. But I was, you know, I was racing it, not to race anyone, but I was racing myself. And I guess that was, you know, I knew I could go and do it and stay in lovely hotels and have a full course dinners every night. It would be lovely. But that wasn't why I paid £1,000 to do this race. So you have to carry all your stuff to sleep on the trail. So you have to have a sleeping bag and a mat and a bivy and things. So you have to be prepared to sleep out in January. But yeah, I had planned to sleep a lot more than I did. I actually found it really hard to sleep in the checkpoints. I think people tracking me were like, oh my God, Lucy's literally just going for it. She's not sleeping. But that was because I couldn't sleep, partly because I developed really bad cold-induced asthma, but partly because the psychology, it's actually really hard. You've been out on your own for 12, 14 hours. Then you get in this busy checkpoint and it's really busy and there's people buzzing around. You're like, right, I've got sleep. I've got 2 hours. I need sleep now. I need sleep 2 hours. If there's 2 hours, I need sleep. I need sleep. I can't sleep. I can't sleep. I can't sleep. And so it's really hard. So then I'd just lie there for half an hour. I'd get up and I'm like, well, I feel a bit better.
Oh my God. So how much sleep did you actually have over those 7 days?
Well, I know. So it only took me, 4.5 days to finish it. And I had until, it was all going very well until the last 24 hours. I think I'd had two like proper sleeps where I'd had one hour, where I was probably asleep for 45 minutes and another one where I was probably asleep for half an hour. And then I was having just like naps, like literally 5 minutes on the side of a trail. But then it all went wrong, horribly wrong in the last 40 miles. And I started falling asleep on my feet and I was literally sleepwalking, going backwards, sleepwalking, would wake up 50 meters off the trail. It was absolutely terrifying.
And were there any kind of edges you could have fallen off, like cliff edges or anything?
No, it was in a good place. It was in Kielder Forest, so you're on tracks. And I would have been okay had it been daylight. I would have just had some naps. But it was so cold, I knew I couldn't stop. The rational part of me knew that I couldn't stop. So I had to keep going because there's this checkpoint and there was a church that you could sleep in. But my body was just saying otherwise and I was falling asleep. And then it was taking me away from where I needed to be. It was the most terrifying experience of my life. I can't even describe how disorientating it was. And I couldn't work out whether I was dreaming. It was like one of those nightmares where I don't know if you ever have them I used to have them before triathlons where you can only run backwards, but it was actually like going backwards. It was terrifying.
So did you finally get to the checkpoint? And
I did. And then I thought it was game over. I ended up having 2.5 hours sleep in the church. And then I think it was about 26 miles left. And I kept kind of just getting by with naps and naps and naps and naps. And so I finished, but it was a very, very slow finish.
And the medical team let you continue, even though you basically couldn't stay awake.
Thing. I mean, I think I just assumed that when I got to see it, I was so disorientated. And then, you know, they took me down to this church and they were like, get your stuff out. You can go to sleep there. It's utterly bizarre. It's just this little church in the middle of nowhere. There's no heating or anything. And people just go down and lie down and sleep on the floor.
Wow.
And I'm in my head. I didn't set an alarm. My race was gone. I was so disorientated. But I woke up and I was so cold.
Are we talking minus degrees here?
Yeah, it was that week in January, I think, was all the news was saying it's the coldest January in 14 years or something. I think it was down to minus 14.
Oh,
or
my God.
Something crazy.
So you're walking on snow as well?
Yeah, we had snow, we had ice. We were, you know, I don't know if anyone saw finished videos, I was like Michelin woman. I was in so many layers. I couldn't get any more layers under my waterproof jacket and my face was all swollen. But yeah, I slept 2.5 hours and actually I did feel a bit better. I just assumed they wouldn't let me finish, but no, crack on, off you go. Because my chest was also really bad. I'd been given an inhaler by the medics, but I was like, in no sense would I have let anyone go. They were like, off you go.
Oh my God. And then you just had another like marathon distance to do in that state.
Yeah, just another marathon. But yeah, what an experience though, because that was why I was doing it, to have those crazy dark holes and see whether I could get out of them, and then gave me everything I wanted.
Do you remember being scared at any moments?
Yeah, there were, that sleepwalking was honestly, it was terrifying, because I've never been out of control like that, where there was half of my brain that was entirely rational and was just get to the checkpoint. And the other half was just falling asleep and then walking me off where I was going. That was terrifying. And the other time was in a blizzard on the top of Crossfell. So Crossfell's one of the high points, and it was really thick snow. And then this blizzard started and it was dark. I'd hoped to get over there before dark, but I hadn't because of the snow and because of my chest. So I was going a lot slower than I thought I would be. And this blizzard came, and my Garmin actually, I found myself off course, but my Garmin had actually frozen, like, literally frozen. So then I was off course in the dark on some boulders with no navigation. And at that point I was like, yeah, this is quite scary. But at the same time I was like, but this is also quite cool. This is why I did it.
Oh my God. Did you think at any point like I could die?
Not really. I don't know. I don't know my brain would have ever got there. I did think these are not situations that I would ever normally be in.
Wow. So what makes you want to put yourself through something so challenging and to take you to kind of that lowest, scariest point?
I think it's, I used to fear failure so much as a kid, and I came last in a cross country race when I was 13, and that stopped me doing anything competitively until I did my first triathlon when I was 26. And I always told myself it was because I didn't like running, but it wasn't. It's because I'd come last and I'd failed, and I hated it. I couldn't deal with it. And I think as an athlete, you face up to failure. And I think that's what I wanted with the spine. I wanted something. It'd been a long time since I'd, I guess I did a 100-mile race in the summer as well as kind of prep for it. And both of those, they felt so impossible. They felt so ridiculous. They felt such high odds that I wouldn't be able to do it. And I think that's kind of what I wanted from the spine race, which it gave me. You know, I was so close to failing. And I remember that with Ironman, like that first Ironman was the first time I realized that when you set yourself up to a goal that does seem impossible and somehow you manage to do it, it's such an incredible feeling. So I think it's a little bit about facing up to failure and also going through the really tough patches, like the highs you get when you come through them. If it was easy, because there is a bit of me with the spine, I was like, if I'd only slept at the last checkpoint, it would have been an amazing race. But then it would have been quite easy. And actually, that wasn't why I was doing it. I wasn't doing it as a race. I was doing it to have those really tough, dark patches and come out the other side.
Wow. And I've also heard you say on another podcast that it's really important for you to understand your why when you're going through these races. So what is your why?
So I think that's... So knowing your why is you particularly with something crazy where there will be tough patches, it's so important to know why you're doing it. And it can never be, you know, for me, a time in a marathon just wouldn't be enough for me to push through when it got tough. So I think my why for the spine was I had this personal why of trying something that felt so big, that felt so impossible, that felt so scary, all the adventures along the way and signing up to that impossible, that crazy thing that I genuinely thought, this is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. But then there was also the why for the charity, and I guess I've talked about how passionate I am about spreading that message, and that kind of became a secondary why, that I could use my spine race to share the story of the charity and moving against cancer and raise some money. But actually, as much as anything, I was blown away by the money we raised, but it was more spreading the message about what we do and the work that we do. And that, you know, the fact that I raised that, I can't remember how much it is, over 32,000, 33,000 or something, including gift aid, is incredible. But that means that all those people who donated know about Move Against Cancer, and a lot of them wouldn't have known about it before.
Yeah, it's a really important why. One of my favourite quotes is Nietzsche, "He who has a why can bear with almost any how."
It's so true though. Whatever it is in life, like if you don't know why you're doing it, like I've just taken on a new role at work about 6 months ago, and it was a real wrestle as to whether I took it on because I knew it was going to be stressful. I knew it was going to be a lot of work. No one else wanted to do it. So there was like, am I just doing it because someone else, you know, no one else wants to do it? Or I don't know. But knowing your why, I just think is so important before making any of those big decisions.
Yeah. And I saw after the spine race on Instagram, you wrote, "The journey has been life-changing. I have no doubt the race will be life-changing." So I wanted to ask you, was it life-changing?
Yeah, it has been. I mean, if anyone read to the end of my blog, they will know that actually my former partner, who we kind of, the spine race is something we'd done together, turns out that he was actually a pathological liar. But so that's life changing.
Oh, wow. But, what actually happened?
I mean, you can't make it up, but long story short, he had been dating someone in London who didn't know about me, who found out about me through the spine.
No.
I mean, it's actually been really upsetting, but I laugh about it. And I just tell everyone because it's easier. So yeah, she found out about me through the spine messenger and contacted my friend who was doing the social media, who didn't believe it, and then ultimately found out it was all true. But that was just the tip of the iceberg in terms of lies. So that has been life changing.
Wow.
But that, I don't want to dwell on that. Has the rest of it? I think it probably has. I'm sure it will inspire more crazy challenges. How crazy, I don't know. But it's reminded me that I really love that feeling of doing something that seems impossible. And I think I will always need to seek that out in life. So it's changed my life in ways that I never imagined.
Wow.
And I guess in ways that I hoped I'd imagine as well.
Twists and turns along the way, hey? But you obviously are a remarkably resilient person. Just to be able to get through that race. And we do talk a lot about resilience on When Life Gives You Lemons. Do you think that you have always been a resilient person, or do you think you've gained some of that from your work as an oncologist or your sporting career?
I think I've been reflecting on this quite a lot, actually, over the last few weeks. Like, what is resilience? And I guess I've realized, like, over the last few weeks since finding out about Andrew and everything that's culminated in that actually my resilience at work has been a lot less than it would normally be, which I guess I kind of ruminate about stuff, and it's something I have been reflecting. I guess, yes, I am resilient because I've kept going to work. I can actually talk about what's happened, and I find that easier than just pretending it hasn't happened because it's part of everything. But I guess my take, again, from just these reflections, I think there's only so much resilience you can have. And if your resilience has been taken away from something, then it does make you less resilient for other stuff. So I can't imagine, you know, if I had found out about Andrew before the spine, I'm 100% certain I wouldn't have been able to finish the spine.
Yeah.
And probably stuff at work is harder to deal with when, you know, in those weeks finding out about Andrew than it would have been otherwise. So I think, yes, I am resilient, but I think everyone is, I would say everyone is resilient, because people who would say they're not resilient, this is what I see at work. When you're handled cards that you have no choice but to deal with, everyone does. And it's one of the things that I love most about work, is seeing how tenacious humans are when they're faced with the unimaginable. So I remember a young guy who, incredible guy, he was in his early 20s. He was walking to the pub. He fell down a curb. He broke his leg. It turned out he had sarcoma in his leg. He had to have 10 weeks of chemo, but in that chemo, he had to be on traction on a bed with his, he couldn't move his leg because it was such high risk of spreading the cancer further. So he was stuck being poisoned for 10 weeks on this bed. Then he had his leg amputated. Then he had another 20 weeks of chemotherapy. And I remember having a chat with him afterwards and saying, he was like, I never thought I'd be the kind of person that could do that. But he did, and everyone does. So I think I'm really rambling, but everyone is resilient. You've only got so much in your resilient well. And I think being, I guess I found that being aware of that actually has been quite helpful. But I'm not sure you can learn it. You can learn coping strategies.
Yeah, I think I'd agree in that. I believe as well that we're all resilient. And I think that when you have something that challenges you, sometimes your strength within that resilience can falter. But what we need to do is kind of dig deep and find that strength and that resilience to overcome. And hopefully, I mean, I hope that you can look back on like your spine race and, you know, just look at what an amazing achievement that is, really.
The only other thing I would say with resilience is, and I say this to my patients, it's also okay not to be okay. You don't have to put up this battle, this kind of wall around you the whole time. And I guess that's something that I would try to give permission to. Yes, you can be resilient, but you also need to be vulnerable as well.
I think you're just remarkable. And thank you for coming on the podcast. I think that we can all learn a lot about mindset and resilience from you, Lucy. So thank you. Thanks for chatting to us today. And I hope that people check you out. And where can they find you if they want to know more?
You can find me on social media, Twitter at Lucy Goss and Instagram, Lucy Gossage. And Move Against Cancer is the charity, and we're on social media. So please give us a follow and find out about what we do.
Thank you, Lucy. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
So that was another remarkable guest, Lucy Gossage, on When Life Gives You Lemons. I think we can all take so much from her regarding mindset, resilience, and the importance of exercise following and during cancer. So please let me know your thoughts on that episode, and then tune back in next week for another amazing guest.